All right, we continue right here on Sports Radio 810 WHB. Jason Anderson with you, Corey Anderson Beards. We head up until 2 o'clock. An hour from now, we'll hang out with Les Norman in studio. Breaking the norm, we'll talk some Royals baseball with him. Vinny Pasquantino looks like he'll make his Major League debut tonight. The trade of Carlos Santana yesterday clearing the path for one of the top Royals prospects. So Les Norman, we'll talk with him. Some other things with the baseball world coming up at noon. Right now, let's talk some football. From The Athletic, Deontay Lee joins us here in the zone to talk about the NFL and some Kansas City Chiefs football as well. Deontay, welcome to the show, man. How are you?
I'm doing well, man. Feeling a little bit better. You know, last week I know we talked about trying to jump on. I was kind of recovering from a little bit of an illness. Not COVID, but I had strep throat, so I was out of commission. You know, I've been kind of joking around with some of my friends that the best silver lining of that is that I got my summer diet started because I dropped about 15 to 20 pounds in about a week's time.
Well, you know,
so I'll take it.
It's not the best way to drop weight, but
no.
it can be effective.
Nonetheless.
Yeah, that's right. Believe me, I've gone through many bouts of strep throat in my life. It is not fun, man. It is not fun. I saw one of the tweets that you put up maybe last week that was like, whatever I say right now, it's something along the lines of whatever I say right now, understand that it, like I'm sick or something. Like, don't take it for like
hungry, dehydrated. Yeah.
Yeah.
Please take everything I say with a grain of salt.
That's right. That's right. Understand that I might be on some meds and I'm hungry, and so I'm not sure what is going to come out of my mouth. Don't
Absolutely.
Take me at my word with that one. Deontay Lee is our guest. Maybe not last week with the sickness, but when it comes to like the NFL and covering the NFL, do you enjoy this little downtime for a month before it's going to be just, you know, July 22nd nonstop until, you know, first week in February and even, you know, after that when you're still assessing the Super Bowl and things like that? So do you enjoy the little bit of downtime, or is it for you just full steam 365?
It's funny, man. Like, I look at it from two perspectives. Like, as a fan, this is where it 100% reveals, like, the unhealthy addiction I have with football content. Because I have caught myself on YouTube multiple times, like, looking for mic'd up footage from OTAs and mandatory mini camps and stuff like that, and watching press conferences on topics that I probably really don't care all that much about right now. I'm just looking for something to kind of consume. So that part is kind of funny, but from a journalistic standpoint, from the media standpoint, this is a great opportunity to kind of look at, you know, taking on some different projects. You know, this year with where flight prices are at, I haven't been able to travel the way that I would, but I would like to be able to go out and kind of embed and spend time with coaching staffs or front offices and things like that. So this will also be a great opportunity for things like that. So it gives you an opportunity to kind of exhale. You know, you get to take I think one last look at the whole landscape of the league. You got to get your predictions in order, how you feel about certain rosters and coaching staffs and things like that. And you can really start to frame, I think, your early perspective on where you think this football season is going to go in this early summer kind of period.
Have you done that in the past where you've, you know, in this downtime where you've traveled and been around some coaching staffs to, you know, see what they do and pick up some of the little intricacies that are, you know, part of whatever staff that might be?
Usually around the college level.
Okay.
Like, you know, for me in San Diego, this is usually a really good opportunity to go sit with, like, San Diego State guys because recruiting is down. You know, the clinic season is over, so they're not traveling to Portland and Las Vegas for all, like, the Nike Coach of the Year clinics and things like that. So this is usually a good time. Like, if you want to get good information, if you want to get them to tell the truth, right, and kind of get out of, you know, the coach speak mode, this is a really good time to do so. I'm traveling to camps and things like that. So that's usually about this. This time is usually when I would do things like that. Now with my job being more NFL-centric, I'm actually looking to go visit a couple of training camps. Like, I know I've talked with some guys that with the Chargers about going to visit with them. You know, some of the people in my job have mentioned maybe going out to Phoenix and visiting with the Cardinals.
Nice.
So, you know, we've got a few different things in the air. You know, I definitely want to go and sit and get some perspective on coaches. And I think one of the things that I do well is because of the way that I talk about the game, you know, there's kind of a disarming effect, I think, that happens with coaches. Like, okay, I can level with this guy about what's happening on the field in a way that they may not feel comfortable with everybody in the media sphere. So I can usually get some good nuggets of information. You know, I kind of saw that at the Combine when I was in Indianapolis, and I'm hoping to kind of build on some of those relationships that I started on, you know, in Indy. once we get into like the training camp period of the year.
It probably helps that they probably look at you and say, well, he may be working in the media and covering these different things and writing. And from a journalistic perspective, certainly that's why he's here. But he's also kind of one of us because he's been a coordinator. He understands the schemes. He speaks our language, right? He understands the vernacular, right? The parlance that we're using, he's right there with us. So probably makes it a little more comfortable for them rather than thinking, okay, there's a journalist in the room here as opposed to there's a football guy in the room with us.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I think every coach, you know, almost reflexively kind of has a code switching element when it comes to talking to the media about football. And some of it's understandable, right? Yeah. Like, it's hard to sit in front of a podium and try to break down exactly what you're asking your edge defender to do against the run. You know, you don't want to dry out the audience, you know, with that kind of information, even though there are people who have a lot of interest in it. You know, there are certain ways or there are certain topics in football that you can't really dumb down, you know, for lack of a better term, right? There's only really one way to describe it or a couple of ways to describe it. So you definitely see coaches try to figure out how they can tamp down on being too, you know, jargony or coach speaky, and then they're obviously trying to protect the information that's important to their team and their franchise, so they don't want to give up too much intel. So that's a piece of it as well. So like I said, I mean, it's always great to be able to go in, sit with these guys and say, hey, man, you know, when you're playing in your 3-4 package and you want to do this, this, and that, I notice that your guy does, you know, one of two things. Like, what is that about? Where does that come from? And you can kind of see that light go off like, oh, okay, I can actually talk about this.
Yeah.
You know, and you kind of get some really good intel, you know, from guys under those kind of contexts. So that's one of the things that I really lean on is the fact that I can speak the way that they like to speak when they're in their offices, you know, when they're having a beer with their, you know, coaching staff or some of the guys that they respect around the league. I think that's an important piece of it. And then from that, because I can translate what they're saying, I can take that information, incorporate it into my writing, and I think kind of give it to the consumers and the readers and the people who watch the game in a way that they can digest it and I think get closer to understanding exactly what it is that their favorite teams are trying to do on Sunday.
Well, I mean, that's why we have you on, because I love reading the stuff and I learn something, and you're right. It is a way, because look, I didn't coach the game, you know, I barely even played the game, you know, so all the schemes and everything, I try to learn as much as I can constantly. And so that's why we love having you on, Deontay Lee of The Athletic. I hope you get a chance to, you know, visit with the Cardinals, because that would be interesting to catch back up with you, because that's the Chiefs' first opponent in week one, just to see what your thoughts on that team might be as the Chiefs will get their season underway against the Arizona Cardinals, visiting with Deontay Lee of The Athletic. I wanted to ask you this before we get into some things about the Chiefs and maybe some bigger picture stuff is what the Chiefs might be looking at this year compared to maybe in years past. But the hearing is going on today for Deshaun Watson there in Cleveland. It seems like the consensus is starting to become that we won't see Deshaun Watson this year, that maybe the NFL will get the indefinite suspension and, you know, for at least a year, and we'll see what happens after that. Do you think he plays this year? And if he doesn't, what do you think Cleveland does?
Honestly, I think the way that the reporting has kind of accelerated over the last, you know, week to 10 days, I would be shocked if we saw Deshaun Watson in the 2022-23 season. I think that the NFL seems to kind of have their mind made up, and I think this is more of just, you know, how much the NFLPA can battle on behalf of, you know, a player that they represent as a union. But I would be shocked if we don't see – I would be shocked if we saw him on the field this year. I think that, you know, in terms of – for Cleveland, you know, I think that now you kind of just have to bite the bullet. I can't imagine for them making a transaction to get him that they were walking into this thinking that, you know, he was just going to be available from week one, mm-hmm. and that they didn't have some kind of idea that this was something that could happen, you know. Now, obviously, you know, because of what they had to give up to get the guy, it's not like you can really put too many contingencies in place. You know, a lot of this offseason for them was just holding the roster together that they had last year as much as possible outside of the Amari Cooper trade and just trying to, you know, bring him in to see if he can kind of jumpstart and get them in a Super Bowl contention mode. So I think that now you just kind of have to eat it. You know, they're not going to have a first-round pick. You hope that this doesn't tank the year. The thing that I'm most interested about with Cleveland is just, like, what the dynamics going to be in the quarterback room now having Baker Mayfield as your immediate backup. You know, I know that we've heard of Jacoby Brissett being the, you know, the de facto starter in the event that Deshaun's not there, but you do still have Baker Mayfield in the building. You know, I think that that's a dynamic that I'm really fascinated to see, you know, how they play that out, you know, how they're able to manage that. Are they going to be put in a position, you know, similarly to Odell Beckham last year where it's just untenable for all parties involved and you just kind of have to cut bait, you know, and eat the dead cap and let the guy walk. So I'm really kind of fascinated to see what that means for them And then in terms of the rest of the conference, you know, not having them in the picture, I think opens the door now for teams in the AFC West, where we know it's going to be very, very competitive, to try to be a home field team throughout the playoffs. You know, losing a team that, you know, we will presume to be one of the more talented ones in the AFC kind of opens the door to say, hey, man, if we get the one seed and we're playing at home, we don't have to go deal with, you know, what is one of arguably the top 5 to 7 quarterbacks in the NFL in our conference. You know, I think that that kind of opens the door for a team like the Chiefs. You know, if the Chargers are able to make all these pieces gel together, you can look at it and say, hey, there's one less thing we got to worry about.
Yeah.
Now it's just winning our division. Maybe we only have to deal with like a team like Baltimore outside of our division as a heavy contender, you know, type of team. And Buffalo, obviously, is another one of those. And only having to deal with maybe two of those is a lot better than maybe having to deal with 3 or 4, you know, in the playoff bracket. So that's kind of what I'm fascinated by right now.
Yeah, Cleveland's a different beast if Deshaun Watson is the quarterback with the roster 100%. That they have. And without him, it's like, okay, they can be a good team, maybe get to 500, maybe knock off a team or two that you wouldn't expect them to knock off. But ultimately be a player to where you're saying Chiefs, Chargers, Bills – Bengals, Ravens, and Browns, and now it's like we'll take that team out, but still a lot of really good teams in the AFC. Deontay Lee from The Athletic, another off the field, non-playing sort of downtime conversation around the Chiefs has been the Tyreek Hill stuff. And real quick, like, what do you make of the drama that's there between Tyreek, Mahomes, and Tua? I know he tried to, clean it up a little bit, but was this just an example of a guy trying to, you know, gas up his new quarterback and Mahomes became collateral damage along the way, that, you know, maybe trying too hard to say that everything's all good with Tua? What do you make of that that drama that's developed between Tyreek, his new guy, and his old quarterback?
I would say that half of it's a little disingenuous, and half of it I do think that it's rooted in something real. Like, I do think that some of this is some general Tyreek Hill saltiness about the fact that it was clear that Kansas City just wasn't going to negotiate to the number that Tyreek Hill was after in his next contract. Like, I definitely think that there's a bit of bitterness in that, right? And that's natural. You know, as a human, you know, you think about all the things you contributed. You go out, win a Super Bowl, go play for another All pro, you know, one of the best receivers that we've had in this era, and to know that the end just kind of comes in that way, and for how, you know, kind of bitter an ending it was last season in the AFC title game, I can certainly understand some hard feelings with the organization. So that part, I think, you can kind of find some justification for. As far as some of the stuff between Tua and Mahomes, that's the stuff that I find to be disingenuous. I do think that he's trying to big up, you know, his current quarterback. I just hate that it has to come at the cost of talking about what I think is the most talented quarterback that we've ever seen, right? Like, there are methods in which you can credit Tua and kind of speak to how excited you are to be in Miami with this new opportunity in a different offense. Maybe you're featured in a way that you weren't in Kansas City, without it coming at the cost of talking about, you know, again, what I believe to be the best quarterback to ever play the sport, you know, who's kind of just building out accolades year over year. You know, none of this has to come at the cost of him, you know, and that's what I think all the eye rolling has come about. You know, it's kind of rooted in, you know, I think all the fans, you know, almost in unison, you know, whether you're a Miami fan or a Chiefs fan or just a casual observer, can look at some of those interviews and some of those quotes and kind of groan and roll their eyes, you know, all at once. So I think that, you know, everybody kind of recognizes what this is. I think that this is all just kind of silly season, too much downtime, too much time in front of microphones, you know, feeling like you have to say something to credit a guy. You know, I was disappointed to hear that, but I'd be lying if I said I was surprised.
Deontay Lee from The Athletic is our guest. And now, how it relates to Patrick Mahomes this upcoming season, or just in general in his career, like, we talk about the greats that have ever lived, and, you know, the Last Dance with Michael Jordan. And we saw, like, all of the different ways that he found motivation, even making some things up in his mind and making them out to be true, even though they were fabricated by himself. Finding that motivation, like those greats that have that sort of that instinct of what continues to drive them, even if you've, you know, had the ultimate success and made it to the top of the mountain, which Mahomes has been an MVP, a Super Bowl MVP. He's made it to the top. You can certainly at some times maybe rest on your laurels if you're that guy. But the motivation seems to be sort of in that Jordan role, to where he's always finding or looking for something to do that. Do you like, is that Is that something that's just natural with guys that are the ultra competitors? I mean, there's probably guys that look for motivation that just aren't that good, and they just, you know, it drives them to even be a guy that can even make the NFL. But Mahomes, with the talent that he has and, you know, the mind that he has for playing the game, and then you throw in this constant sort of drive of somehow having a chip on his shoulder when he might, you know, the most talented quarterback that's ever played. It's just different when you get that. And I don't think he needs extra motivation, but I think he got it this summer.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, you know, again, like you said, for all the top competitors, you're always looking for something to compete with. You have to generate that, you know. And once you do reach the pinnacle, there is a kind of a factor of, hey, I've got to be able to gin this up, even if it doesn't exist in the way that I have it in my head, right? You have to be able to create something to push yourself against, right? And I think that, well, one of the beautiful things for Mahomes right now is that he's been kind of spoon-fed all the motivation in the world over this season, right? You know, all the conversations on the big platforms about, you know, have teams figured this thing out? Have they figured the Chiefs out? You get the roster turnover. You're bringing in some new guys, some younger guys. You lose your top wide receiver. You know, and in a lot of ways, you can kind of just convince yourself to like, hey, now it's me against the world, right? It's me and Travis Kelce and Andy Reid, this thing that we've been building, you know, on the offensive end over the years. We've had to change, you know, some things in terms of personnel and maybe, you know, a little bit of an adjustment in identity. And now it's like, hey, can you make this happen without your top guy? Can you make this happen after, you know, that up and down start, you know, to the 2021 season? Can you make this happen after Joe Burrow comes and takes the AFC in a way that I don't think people expected last year? Mm-hmm. So I think that he's been kind of giving, you know, some of the perfect motivation for a guy who not only has reached the pinnacle, but is now in kind of that midpoint of your career, right? He's a full-blown veteran now, on his second, you know, years into a second contract now. Now you're starting to see some of the roster turnover, things that we've seen with quarterbacks like Aaron Rodgers and Tom Brady and Peyton Manning, right? Like, how do you, quote-unquote, remake yourself over time? Can you prove that you're still the greatest as the circumstances change around you? This is one of the first opportunities I think that Patrick has to really kind of prove that, and I expect him to, you know, rise to the occasion, because I don't have any reason to believe that he can't or that he wouldn't. You know, and I, like I said, I think that this is a perfect opportunity to really be able to go out and show people, hey, this is what I'm about still. I think that people are maybe trying to look for the shiny new thing, which you all have a habit of doing after we get, you know, kind of used to what we have in front of us over time. And I think that now this is a perfect opportunity, like I said, to go out and show that he is still the exact same uber talented quarterback that we've always known him to be.
You've written about the two deep, the shell coverage, and what the Chiefs have gone up against this year, this past year, and, you know, since that Bucs game, and people saying, you know, was that the blueprint? Have teams figured out the Chiefs? And for a time, like, it felt like that was the case, and it was, you know, how can this offense, these weapons, this talent be, you know, stymied by a specific defense that, you know, is not brand new? It's not like they're not playing with 12 guys on the field. You know, it's just a different type of scheme. And it seemed to rattle them at times throughout the season. Joe Burrow talked about that they expect to see a lot of that this year. I think other quarterbacks, I think it's the new in vogue defense. So I'm wondering, like, how quickly the Bengals get adjusted to that, if that's the case. Some other teams as well, if they're going to start seeing it more often than not. And I bring that up for how it relates to the Chiefs, Deontay, and that, you know, I've talked about this a couple of times, that, you know, the last 7.5 games, I don't know what happened at halftime of the Bengals game and who Patrick Mahomes turned into in those final two quarters and one possession in overtime. But in the last 7.5 games, last 5 games of the regular season, 2 games in the playoffs and first half against the Bengals, he had a 123 quarterback rating, averaged 330 yards per game, 73% completion percentage, 23 touchdowns and 2 interceptions. So I'm wondering, like, did they figure out the defense and how to really attack it, and Mahomes sort of get into that mode of, this is what they're doing, this is what we'll do, and this is how we're going to go out and execute?
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of the stats, you know, some of the things that you were speaking to, some of the more advanced stats, I think, suggested the same thing. You know, there was a change in usage with Tyreek Hill against some of those two deep shells, you know, in terms of his average depth of target. I think it had dropped a bunch, because I think one of the things they understood was, hey, we've got to generate offense in a different way under these parameters, which is, you know, more yards after catch, you know, types of situations, trying to get the ball in the guy's hands and allow them to go create offense. Getting the ball out of Patrick Mahomes' hands quicker, so that way he doesn't feel like, hey, I'm under the pressure of the pass rush, and, you know, I'm looking at these two deep shells that are taking away these vertical throws, right? So just trying to be more efficient under those contexts. I think we saw them, you know, quote unquote, figure out at least the best way to attack that, you know, in the future. And I think that we're going to see a bunch of that. And I think that it kind of speaks to some of the moves that they made. And number one, you know, you want to be able to run the ball against two deep shells because that's just the way the football works. If you're light in the box, you want to be able to punish that. But if that's what you're going to see regardless, then, hey, you want guys who can work in those underneath the intermediate areas in a different way than what they had been doing, you know, in terms of being a little bit more vertical against some of those single high shells that they were seeing in that, you know, 2018 to 2020, you know, phase of this offense. Mm-hmm. So I think that, you know, what you were saying statistically, I think is kind of borne out by the film. They were able to kind of figure out a way to adjust their identity on the fly. Like you said, I have no greater explanation than what you do for what happened in the second half of the AFC title game.
Yeah.
But I think that everything walking up to that point showed that Patrick Mahomes figured himself out. You know, he didn't lose his composure, wasn't forcing the ball anymore. And I think that once he stopped trying to find, you know, those deep over routes, you know, those more vertical passes that I think were being taken away from by the defenses, he settled right back into being the most talented quarterback in the NFL again. So I don't expect him to, you know, I don't expect it to take that kind of learning curve over the course of this season again. I certainly don't expect that.
The learning curve thing is interesting. You bring that up. Deonte Lee from The Athletic is our guest. One of the things that we've wondered around here and wanted your thoughts and experience of being around the game, everybody's going to be different and understanding that, but how long do you think there is an adjustment for young guys, rookies coming into defensively for this team? Because there's a chance, you know, at times they might have four rookies out of the 11 on the field defensively for this team. And in a Spags defense that we know isn't exactly like, hey, here's plan A, just go and play. It's not Tecmo Bowl you're choosing between, you know, six plays on defense.
Yes.
Like, it's going to be pretty
exactly.
intricate. Like, how long do you expect maybe an adjustment for the younger guys? Is it half season, most of the season, do you think? And, you know, they sort of figure this thing out earlier in the year when the schedule is pretty tough? Like, because that's going to be a big part of how good this Chiefs team can be. And defensively as well, some of these young guys picking up the scheme quickly.
I mean, I think that in a lot of ways, that actually might be the story of, you know, how high the ceiling of this Chiefs team is going to be, is what the learning curve is for those young defensive players. And it's on a scale, kind of based on where guys are at. For a player like George Karlaftis, who's just going to be on the line of scrimmage, a lot of what Steve Spagnuolo does in terms of, like, the intricacies on the back end and the pressures is to allow those front four guys to really just go be world wreckers, right? That's the reason why Chris Jones is who he is. As a player, right? Like, I think that a lot of this is just trying to free up as much as possible for those guys up front to just go be the best versions of themselves that they can be. So for a guy like Karlaftis, I'm not so concerned. For a guy like Trip McDuffie, who's kind of going to go and play a little bit outside, you know, going to have to be a slot defender at different points, he's going to have, I think, a much bigger load of learning in terms of understanding the scheme, what Spags wants him to do in terms of being a guy, you know, are you going to use him as a blitzer? Or is he going to be more of a coverage guy? And based on that answer, it's kind of going to have, you know, this cascading effect of how much he has to learn, you know, in these different defenses. You know, he'll run everything under the sun, you know, and I've said this before, you know, I've never seen a blitz, you know, that exists in football that Steve Spagnuolo hasn't used and isn't a fan of.
Yeah.
You know, he'll do whatever it takes, you know, to create havoc in the backfield, you know, when he feels like it's appropriate, and he'll rotate coverages in any way that he needs to in order to confuse quarterbacks. So, for a guy like Trip McDuffie, I definitely think that he's going to have, you know, a heavy load of learning. You know, and I'm really kind of fascinated now, having lost Tyrann Mathieu, you know, having Justin Reed, I think, is now that next kind of safety in line. You know, are they going to be as intricate on the back end? You know, because you are going to have, you know, a lot of learning to do in the secondary in general. You know, they lost a few guys that played a heavy amount of snaps, you know, for them over the past few years. The Spags has been there as DC. He's never going to be a guy that's like, you know, he's never going to be a Gus Bradley, as an example, right, where, you know, hey, it's four down, we're playing cover three, we're not blitzing, you know, everybody knows where everybody's going to be lined up, we're just running to the football, right? It's never going to be that, but I do wonder if he tamps down on it, and if not, you know, for a guy like Trent McDuffie, for a guy like Justin Reed, who's a veteran but is new to this defense, you know, is it going to take another, you know, 5-6 weeks into the year before they figure out, okay, these are the things that everybody's good at, that everybody's comfortable with, we can go out and execute this and then build off of that the way that it was last year, you know, waiting for, you know, that acquisition of Melvin Ingram to kind of really help them sort out who they were going to be defensively on the back end of the season.
Yeah, I mean, look, they turned it on in 2019 and won a Super Bowl that year, and they were pretty rough in the first half. And Spags even said, look, it's going to take so there's going to be a learning curve this year. And when you're going through it week by week, it's tough to look at the bigger picture and go, okay, this is part of the learning curve. Looking back, you're like, after that Tennessee game in 2019, the defense was one of the best in the NFL. And Spags has already said the same thing about this team, that, you know, this is – we're going to try to figure some things out. I'm not sure that we'll have it by week one, but you know, we're gonna figure out what these guys can do, where they're supposed to be at. They'll, you know, pick it up, and we'll see what happens along the way. But certainly there's going to be a process and some growing pains along the way. So saying the same thing this year, and certainly hopefully, you know, for the Chiefs' sake, that, you know, it turns out much the same way it did in 2019, because I think there's talent. I think there's more talent on this Chiefs defense this year with the acquisitions and the draft picks than there was a year ago, but there's less experience and less familiarity with what Spags is wanting to do. So we'll see how dimensional they can be. Deontay Lee of The Athletic joining us. Deontay, great stuff, man. Very much appreciate the time. I'm glad that you're on the mend. Enjoy a little bit of downtime. Hopefully you can get to some of those camps, and we'll talk soon, man. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. I always love you guys having me on. Thank you guys, and have a good one.
Absolutely. You too. There's Deontay Lee. Love talking to that guy. The Athletic, really good stuff. And, man, I hope he does go and hang out with the Cardinals for a few days, because that would be interesting to pick his brain then after that, just to, you know, because he would tell us all of the off-the-record stuff. He would, because it would just be us talking, right? Nobody else. But no, not the off-the-record stuff, just his view of, hey, here's what I think the Cardinals are going to be, and here's what I'm seeing from them. And because that's game number one, and that learning curve comes fast, man. I mean, week one is right around the corner. There's 9 more Sundays without football. I mean, putting it into that perspective, like, that learning curve is fast, man. You better be ready to go. And the Chiefs at times will have 4 rookies on the field out of the 11. We know about McDuffie and Karlaftis, but Chennault and Cook, I mean, there's going to be times where all 4 of those guys are on the field. And, I mean, that's, you know, almost half of your defense is going to be rookies, guys that are going to have to get used to Spags' scheme. And it's interesting, he sort of parsing the two of Karlaftis. Yeah, he's on the defensive line. Go get the quarterback, man. Here's your responsibility on this. Yeah, you got to set the edge. All right, maybe you're running a stunt on this particular play, but, you know, here's what we need you to do. Whereas McDuffie, you're playing on the outside. Are you playing in the slot? Okay, you're going to match up in this particular defense. Okay, now you're blitzing. All right, well, now you're covering this area in a zone, but you also need to be ready to come up and stop the run. There's a lot more on McDuffie's shoulders as a rookie never playing in the NFL than there is on George Karlaftis. And I think that's one of the reasons why they liked McDuffie so much, is we talked with his cornerback coach at Washington, and he said McDuffie took pride in knowing what every single player's responsibility was for every single play. The defensive tackle, he said, he knew what the defensive tackle was supposed to be doing every single play, because it was understanding the scheme as to why this was going on and how it all worked together. So if he's that much of a, as they said, a football Mensa mind, if he's that smart, then if that's the guy who's going to have to carry a heavier load, hopefully that's going to translate, and he's the same thing in the NFL. We'll see what happens with that. Thank you to Deontay Lee from The Athletic. We'll take a timeout. We'll come back. We'll continue rolling. We'll talk some baseball with Les Norman coming up at noon. But I also want to get into a couple of things that we heard. There's a couple of podcasts out there you know, weighing in on and just telling stories, Patrick Queen, about a fight in college with Joe Burrow, which I thought was an interesting soundbite, and also Mary Kay Cabot. Of course, with Deshaun Watson's hearing going on today, love to hear what Mary Kay Cabot has to say about that. We'll take a timeout. We'll continue rolling. It's The Zone on a Tuesday at Sports Radio 810 WHB.
The Zone with Jason Anderson.
Our big package.
Weekdays from 10 to 2 on Sports Radio 810 WHB.
I want to talk some football here, continue talking some football here. We'll talk some baseball with Les Norman, but I do want to pass along some big news. About 5 minutes ago, the Royals have put out their lineup for tonight. Already, they have set their lineup for tonight. Already, it's 11:30 in the morning.
Vinny Pasquantino in right field.
He's actually in center. They have traded Michael A. Taylor for Mike Trout. It's odd why they would do that, why the Angels would do that, but they would. Good on John Sherman taking on payroll like that. Vinny Pasquantino is in the lineup. Here's how the lineup goes for today for your Kansas City Royals. Batting first, playing second is Whit Merrifield. Batting second in left field is Andrew Benintendi. Batting third at shortstop is one Bobby Witt Jr. Behind the dish, batting fourth is MJ Melendez. First base, batting fifth, Hunter Dozier. DH, batting sixth, Vinny Pasquantino. Center fielder, batting seventh, Michael A. Taylor. Kyle Isbell in right, batting eighth, and Nicky Lopez at third, batting ninth. Vinny Pasquantino DHing, batting sixth tonight for the Royals.
That's kind of a bummer. I wish
my guess
was
is
in
tomorrow
field.
He'll be playing first.
And yeah, batting but I mean for his debut, sixth. Man, I wish he got, you know, be
maybe
out
the,
on the field.
Maybe and... the debut is to let's. You're not the savior for this team, Vinny. We want to make sure you know you are not the savior. So you get called up, and we're not going to play you. And then the next day, you're going to be DH. And then the afternoon game on Wednesday, we'll put you in the field. Your family will still be there, and you'll play a little first base. Boy, it would have been nice if either Hunter Dozier just simply make the pick at first, or if it were Santana, not like he's amazing at making the picks, but he did it with the previous Jeter-esque play from Bobby Witt over the weekend, or maybe even Vinny Pasquantino, who's an everyday first baseman, maybe more used to those in-between hops that are there. But man, Bobby Witt got him at first if Dozier makes the pick last night in what was a much more impressive play than the one that was making its rounds with the Derek Jeter jump throw. The one he had last night was way more impressive, and he gets him by a half step if Dozier just makes the scoop.
Vinny scoops it.
I think so, too.
You know, but why?
Prado does.
Why do they have to keep running Dozier out at first base? You brought up Vinny Pasquantino.
I don't get it. I mean, are they going to trade? Are they going to DFA Dozier? Is that the next one? It's Hunter DFA Dozier. What are they going to do with this guy? Because you're blocking somebody at first base. I mean, this team has 35 first basemen, apparently. They've got Santana, they've got O'Hearn, they've got Dozier, they've got Pasquantino, they got Nick Prado. I think Salvi can play first. Melendez can play first. He also plays right field. Might even be able to play a little third base as well. They got a lot of first basemen on this team. They just have to, you know, move O'Hearn to a pinch hitter, trade Carlos Santana, then trade Hunter Dozier. You're going to see Pasquantino out there every day. No, I think this is part of the slowly bringing him up to the big leagues that, you know, he's not the savior. But he'll be batting sixth tonight after Dozier, and he'll be DHing. So hopefully you see him five times.
You tricked me when you read the lineup.
I did?
You go playing first base, batting fifth.
It's Hunter Dozier.
Say Vinny Pasquantino.
Ah, so close.
I was like, oh, they're batting him fifth as well. No,
so close. Edward Olivares is not in the lineup tonight, as you know, Kyle Isbell's playing right field. And since those two home runs on Friday night, he has struggled with the strikeouts. Had a couple more last night. Had four of them on Sunday. He did have a single on Sunday. Got thrown out trying to stretch it into a double. But the single was also a pop-up into short right field that resulted in the collision. But he was still thrown out at second. He's struggled, and he had a couple of rough plays in right field. So Isbell is playing right and batting eighth. And I don't care if John Gray is right-handed, left-handed, or ambidextrous. Nicky Lopez at third base tells you what you need to know about their view of Emmanuel Rivera.
Mm-hmm. Because it's not like you got to keep Nicky's bat in,
yeah,
and just find a place to put him on the field.
No, he bats left-handed, and Rivera bats right-handed. So therefore, with John Gray's a righty, last night was Lopez a lefty, you're platooning Nicky Lopez and Emmanuel Rivera at third? Boy, you want to talk about a logjam at first and a black hole at third. No wonder they were having Bobby Witt at third and Adalberto Mondesi at short. But you know what? Move Adalberto Mondesi to a third if you think he's going to be a part of the team in the future. But third base, or move MJ Melendez to third.
Question for you. Do you think the Royals team shop right there behind home plate.
Okay.
Has Pasquantino number 9 jerseys for sale yet tonight.
I would hope, because then his family can be wearing them tonight.
And a lot of people like to be first.
That's true.
Want to go buy one?
What do you think he does tonight? What's his line? We'll give him 4 at bats. 4 plate appearances, sorry. Let's see. Cuz if
4
the guys,
grand slams.
You think so?
Yeah. Nothing else. Yeah, I mean, he's not going to be the savior, but you know, 4 grand slams.
Going against a decent
pitcher.
They score
16 runs, and all 16 runs come on 4 home runs for Pasquantino.
Well, that's just from him.
Yes. He would break the record for RBIs in a game. He would also be the first Royal ever to have 4 home runs in one game. And I'm assuming the first ever player with 4 grand slams in one game.
It's got to happen at some point.
You are right. There's got to be a Royal at some point that will have 4 home runs in a game.
I think he gets a single.
I'm going to go 1-for-3, a single and a walk.
That'd be nice.
And a strikeout.
Be a good start. That's what I'm going
to go with. 1-for-3.
Did you get a steak with that single?
I'm not sure.
Depends on if somebody's on second or third.
That's exactly right. Come on, man. You got some steaks out there. Come through. Come through, man. But yeah, it would be cool if there's a time that would be Whit Melendez Pasquantino Olivares. Because again, that's also assuming that they view Olivares the way that I do, understanding that Olivares is struggling right now. But see those 4 guys in a row that maybe in a couple of years are also guys that are mainstays in the lineup. We'll see. But Vinny Pasquantino making his major league debut tonight, batting 6th. I'm going to guess bottom of the 2nd inning is where we will see Vinny Pasquantino. I'm just throwing a dart.
And odds are he goes 0-for, but I want to be positive and say that he's going to get a base knock. Bobby Witt Jr. got one. Melendez got a hit in his debut too, right?
I think it was the next night.
Was it his next night?
I think it was the next night he went opposite field.
Because he reached base safely in 16 of his first 18 or something like that.
I think the first night he went 0-for. I could be wrong. Maybe it was his 3rd at bat or something. But he laced one into left field that it was wow, this guy has no problem going opposite field.
I will tell you.
This guy's at bat. His approach is pretty phenomenal.
He went 1-for-3.
So it was in his first game.
1-for-3 with a walk.
Interesting.
Yep.
So it must have been his last at bat because it was later on in the game. Are you sure? Man.
I'm looking at May 3rd, his first game.
I guess I just read,
7-1 victory over the Cardinals.
Yeah.
He went 1-for-3 with a walk.
I think one of those 2 outs was one where he crushed to left field and it was almost got it all. But then his hit was to left center where he just, hit the ball hard. Hopefully, I'll take that right now from Vinny Pasquantino. I'll also take Beard's prediction as well. 4-for-4, 4 grand slams.
Be decent.
16 RBI. Does he have a walk? Because if he got 16 runs, he's going to bat more than 4 times. So,
does he think he is? Stephen Kwan?
No, everything else is a strikeout.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. That would be disappointing. That would be if he goes 4-for-7 with 4 home runs and 4 grand slams and 3 strikeouts. Oof. Ouch. That's rough. That is rough. It's a pretty good slugging percentage, though.
So. I mean, listen, he can't be perfect. He's not the savior.
That's a good point. He is not the savior.
But as the texter points out, they did give him Roy Hobbs' number.
Oh, good point.
So what kind of expectations are they putting on him?
Is he batting with Wonder Boy?
He won't have the pressures of worrying about his defense tonight. So
that's exactly right.
He can just focus on getting that first big league hit.
Yep. Of course, was MJ Melendez was his first game as a DH, too?
MJ Melendez.
Did you look that up?
His first game was as a catcher.
Okay, so he was behind the plate.
Oh, wait, hang on.
Hold on.
Sorry, that was June 1st. As a DH, yes.
Okay, so they've done it with MJ Melendez, now doing it with Vinny Pasquantino as well. So DHing tonight. And look, Rex Hudler talks about all the time that it's a tough job for a younger guy to DH. You know, what are you doing in between your at-bats? The only thing you're doing is getting an at-bat. So I think the time might fly for Vinny Pasquantino tonight watching the game and getting his at-bat. So we'll see. 913-912-4810. I want to play this clip. This is from let's play the one from Braden Fajoco first. He is a defensive lineman for the Los Angeles Chargers. He played his first 2 years at Texas Tech and then transferred to LSU. So we played with Patrick Mahomes and Joe Burrow. Let's hear the one about spring practice. There's the clip in there that's about him talking about Patrick Mahomes at Texas Tech, which we can play at some point. But I want to bring together the this clip and then the Patrick Queen one from a podcast from yesterday, too. Here's Braden Fehoko, a defensive lineman for the Chargers, played at LSU, and spring practice. There's stories coming out about actual fights that were taking place with that LSU team at spring practice with the defense against the offense and Joe Burrow, the quarterback, and actual fist fights taking place in practice. Here's Braden Fehoko weighing in on the Joe Burrow spring practice fight.
Separated Joe, you thought, from the rest of the quarterbacks in the country.
So senior year, spring ball. I mean, it's, you know how it is, bro. Nobody wants to practice during spring ball. We're doing red zone, and you know how Coach O is. He stops the period before we get into the red zone, and he's like, I want good on good, best on best. I want you to rip somebody's ass. And so they do like a play action, and Joe like runs a fade. So he throws the fade, and D-line just reaching for the quarterback. Patrick Queen like just kind of overreaches and like hits Joe, and it's not a hard hit. But it's the quarterback. It's crazy. Like, usually you hit a quarterback, the O-line's fighting and stuff. The first person to throw a punch was Joe. And then after that, like, he was like, no, f*** that. Like, keep him out. We're going to finish this period. Diced us up.
Diced us up, did Joe Burrow. Now, that's the Cliff Notes version of what took place.
Okay.
Here's Patrick Queen yesterday on a podcast, and the question was about Joe Burrow, and here's Patrick Queen weighing in about that. The conversation goes and moves to the competitiveness between Burrow and Patrick Queen, and when they kind of felt like this team was going to be different. He goes back to spring practice talking about what Braden Fehoko just brought up in that fight with Joe Burrow.
How bad they was torching us. Like, we was fighting every day. Like, when we get a stop, we were talking so much trash that it was a battle. Like, everybody just wanted to fight.
Well, yeah, there's rumors that there was a fight whenever Joe Burrow got into it with, who was it? Was it Divinity?
Me, Devin?
Or was
me,
it Devin White? Or
me,
you?
Me, Devin, and Jacoby all got into
boy,
it.
Boy, he tried to fight with all that's a fight. It's probably not going to win, but I was ready that. Yeah.
But, like, the crazy part is, so, like, I forgot how his and Devin started. I think Devin was talking trash or something. But Jacoby, so we was at practice, the spring practice, one of the hottest practices ever. Jacoby blitzes and hit Joe. So Coach O stops it, and they get up wrestling and stuff, and then Coach O stops it and is like, hey, don't hit Joe. So Joe over there sitting talking trash. So I'm like, okay, cool. So the next play come, I hit Joe. Boom.
On purpose.
On purpose. So Coach O is like, hey, don't hit Joe. I'm not going to say it no more. So we're like, okay. We get back in the huddle. We're going to hit Joe again. So Joe rolls out on a pass, throws a pass down. It's incomplete. I push him. Start talking trash, jumping in his face, like doing like a little cowboy dance in his face and stuff. And I just, all I see is him just reach back, boom, punch me with the face mask on and everything. I look. I said, Joe really just hit me. And next thing you know, we were all wrestling, we're on the ground, we're fighting. So I'm, me and Joe on the ground, I got Joe in a headlock. And he's sitting there, he's punching me in the stomach, like steady punching me. So I'm on the ground, I got on my gears, and our bench is that way. So I see him. And all I see is Jacoby running from like 30 yards. He runs in and just smokes you. Boom. So we're like, bro, we are bad. Like, we got to stop.
It's not good.
We got to stop. And then
the quarterback.
It probably took us like 5 minutes to get separated. And once they separated, Coach O was looking at us. Coach O was like, what are y'all fighting for? Why are y'all hitting Joe? Like, it's not that hard. But he was like so calm and chill and like laughing. Like, he was just like, he knew.
He knew. I guess he knew at that point, like, not only did he have a defense that just didn't give a bleep, but he also had a quarterback that was willing to fight the defensive players because they were coming after him and hitting him. Which is great. Don't touch Joe. Let's go hit Joe.
I kind of like that. Makes me like Joe Burrow a little bit more.
I agree.
Hearing, like, that story, like, he's going to mix it up because, you know, quarterback, like, yeah. Don't hit me. Like, just get mad or whatever, but don't do anything about it. And Joe Burrow's like, no, we're going, man. It's time.
He punched him when he had the helmet on. That's not smart.
That's dumb.
You probably wouldn't want to do that if you're the quarterback. But then, you know, Devin White or Patrick Queen sitting there talking about he's got him in a headlock. He's got him in a headlock, and Joe Burrow's just punching his stomach while he's in a headlock, and Jacoby Stevens comes from 30 yards away running full sprint and just smokes Joe Burrow.
It sounds like there was also some maybe a little bit of animosity, at least early. I'm sure that grew into admiration because Burrow had one of the greatest seasons in the history of college football. But early on, it sounds like they might have thought, why is this guy getting the protection?
Yeah.
Maybe he hasn't quite earned it yet. We're going to make him.
You don't touch the quarterback.
Break him in a little bit.
I love that Ed O was just like, what are y'all doing? Why are you doing that? Just like, why are you touching? Like, he didn't stop the Joe Burrow got hit three plays in a row, according to Patrick Queen, and that the practice was not stopped. Instead, Ed O was calm and was like, all right, we'll see what we got this year. Yeah, I mean, look, the Joe Burrow comparisons to Mahomes get annoying, and so then you go and tear down Burrow. But as far as, like, a quarterback and, like, you know, respecting his game and, like, you know, I kind of like the way that he goes about it and how sort of in your face he is. I like Burrow from that standpoint. Now, if he keeps winning, I will hate him.
Mm-hmm.
He will be somebody that will be easy to hate.
If he stays undefeated against Patrick Mahomes,
yes,
F that dude.
Right. Because Mahomes is, like, viewed as, like, oh, he's this cocky player. Like, Mahomes has gone from, and the worm always turns, he's gone from this new thing in 2018 that everybody loved and marveled at to then, he's overrated, not as good as everybody makes him out to be, and he's so cocky anyway. Burrow's like this new guy, like, look what he did. Burrow comes in, look what he did at LSU. Now, I mean, if he continues to win and put up numbers, he will quickly be viewed as, wow, this dude is so cocky, and I just can't stand him from what he's doing. But it's been that way since college, and willing to fight Patrick Queen, Devin White, and Jacoby Stevens, all guys playing in the NFL. So there you go. The origin of that LSU team that was one of the best from Braden Fajoko, who played on the defensive line, that pointed to that spring practice as to, like, when he knew Joe was different. And Patrick Queen pointed to that exact spring practice when he knew that Joe was different than others. So interesting from that standpoint. We'll take a timeout. We'll wrap up this hour next.
The Zone with Jason Anderson.
I'm just being a smartass.
Weekdays from 10 to 2 on Sports Radio 810 WHB.
All right, we continue right here on Sports Radio 810 WHB. Jason Anderson with you. Corey Anderson. Beards. We'll hear from Les Norman coming up in the noon hour. 913-912-4810 is the text line to be a part of the show, part of the conversation. 913-912-4810 to join us. Text says that was old news. Well, the Patrick Queen stuff was out a few months ago. We had never played it. I had never seen it. But the Fajoko one was released yesterday.
You mean the Fajoko one was?
No, the Fajoko one was released yesterday.
Gotcha.
It was like a 30-minute sit-down with him, and he was talking about when he played with Mahomes, when he played with Burrow, and then, like, hey, when was Burrow different? And he was, like, talking about this fight, which then people were linking to the, well, here's Patrick Queen talking about more in-depth about the fight a couple of months ago, you know, after the Super Bowl and everything like that, which I hadn't heard before. And I'm glad people linked it because, you know, just the, you know, Fajoko saying, like, oh, yeah, you know, that's there was a fight that broke out, and that's when we knew it was different.
Yeah, Queen's version was much better.
Much better. You get in-depth as to why the fight broke out. It wasn't just like, because Fajoko was like, yeah, they Queen maybe went a little too far and pushed them, and then a fight, like, no, it was three plays in a row where they specifically went out of their way to hit Joe Burrow. Yeah. We'll talk with Les Norman, a man you would not want to go out of your way to hit. He's from Breaking the Norm. He joins us next.